The former leader of Panama, Manuel Noriega, has arrived in France after being extradited from the United States, where he spent almost 20 years in jail for drug trafficking.
Manuel Noriega is to appear before French prosecutors later today. The French claim that he laundered about $3 million in drugs proceeds in France in the 1980s by buying property in Paris.
A French court had already convicted Manuel Noriega in absentia on these charges back in 1999. In March this year, after exhausting legal appeals against his extradition from the States, Noriega was taken to France, where the government had agreed to give him a new trial. But in July, he was convicted again and sentenced to 7 further years in jail, this time in France. I'm Keri Phillips, here with Rear Vision on Radio National Summer. Today we'll follow the former Panamanian dictator's decline from valued US ally to drug-smuggling pariah. R.M. Costa is a writer and retired university professor. A native New Yorker, he went to Panama as a soldier in 1957, and he's lived there ever since.
Noriega was the illegitimate son of a laundress. She was tubercular, and she gave him away right after he was born to an aunt. And she died before he was 1 year old. And thinking about him so much for years, I thought that probably that was the key to him, that if your mother abandons you, what can you be worth? And that, I think, is what drove him to get so much power and so much money. He went to a public high school, which was probably the best high school in the country, and it was open to people of all classes, free of tuition, depending on examination. And he graduated with the class of 1952. My brother-in-law was a classmate of his. While at the National Institute, he became an informant for the 470th Military Intelligence Detachment in the Panama Canal Zone, the U.S. Army. And that's what gave him his start in the world's second oldest profession. And I think that's the other key to him. Clandestine activity, exactly what a person who's extremely poor, extremely ugly, and many reasons not to like himself. But secretly, you see, he was an important fellow.
He seemed to be a natural-born intelligence agent. He wanted to know things. And he was good at it and was very highly regarded by a lot of U.S. people when he operated in the shadows. He was a kind of celebrity in the clandestine world.
Kevin Buckley is a former reporter and the author of Panama, The Whole Story.
His association with CIA is usually dated at about 1966. In 1968, a hugely important thing happened in Panama. The military took over firmly a man named Omar Torrijos. But Omar Torrijos was a singular fellow, beloved by Graham Greene and Jimmy Carter and all sorts of people. Charismatic, populist, heavy drinker. And he seized power in 1968. Noriega was his right-hand man. Torrijos used to refer to him in Spanish as my gangster. He was the fixer. He could get things done.
When you run a dictatorship, you have to hurt people, especially the kind of dictatorship that Omar Torrijos ran. And Manuel Noriega had pathologies that were very useful to Torrijos. He was, on the one hand, the main torturer, and sometimes he would practice himself, but the idea was that you've got to scare people if you're going to dictate to them, and Noriega scared them in various ways. He also was the head of the illegal businesses that the Guardia Nacional ran. This was a continuing criminal enterprise. Started out with whiskey smuggling, moved very quickly into drug smuggling, arms smuggling, fake passports, etc. When Sanchez and I did the book, we had, I think, 18 or 20 separate rackets. And Noriega was the overseer for all of that. So he was very, very useful to Omar Torrijos. And Omar Torrijos advanced him, made him head of intelligence. And Noriega was also a considerable mind. He was able to keep all that stuff in his head. He was able to run the different rackets, and it's not a sort of thing that you could, you know, put down on paper, and you can't delegate much of it. And he was also able to operate on a level with Pinochet's intelligence and Castro's intelligence, Mossad and the PLO. He swam with all the sharks. And that was the genesis of his power in the country and of his wealth.
The most important event of the Torrijos years was the negotiation of a new treaty with the United States under President Jimmy Carter in 1977. The original Canal Treaty, signed in 1903, had given the United States control of the canal they built between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, as well as a large slice of land on either side. The American presence in the canal zone, backed up militarily, had long rankled with Panamanians, and although U.S. Republicans like Ronald Reagan were strongly opposed, the Torrijos-Carter Treaty promised to return control of the canal to Panama in 1999. John Dingers was a longtime journalist in Latin America and is the author of Our Man in Panama. He says that during the 1970s, Noriega's relationship with the CIA bloomed.
Noriega went to Washington in 1976. He was now head of intelligence, and he meets with George Bush. George Bush Sr. was then the head of the CIA. They had a very cordial meeting, and it was the beginning of a long relationship of collaboration between Noriega and the U.S. CIA. It was a paid relationship. He received about $10,000 a month, and over the period of a number of years received several $100,000 from the United States, both from the Pentagon and from the CIA. I don't think you should understand this as him being in the pocket of the United States. It was a relationship of mutual benefit. He did favors for us, we did favors for him. Of course, the backdrop, the dark side of all of this, this is, of course, the United States dealing with a dictatorship, not an unusual arrangement. But perhaps more seriously, this was a man, Manuel Noriega, probably his boss, Omar Torrijos, who were involved in the beginnings of the cocaine trade in Latin America in the late 1970s. Cocaine was starting to be produced in Colombia. And the first shipments, I mean, this is nowhere near the enormous quantities of cocaine that we're seeing nowadays. Cocaine really was a very minor thing in the world of drug trafficking. People paid much more attention to heroin coming from the Middle East. But cocaine was beginning to be important, and it was very profitable. And Noriega was in at the beginning having a piece of the shipment business so that cocaine was able to be shipped from Colombia, where it was produced, through various countries of Central America, sometimes through Panama, and would eventually make its way to the United States.
Omar Torrijos died when his plane went down in bad weather in 1981.
Guillermo and I believe that that plane crash was a bona fide crash. There was a terrible thunderstorm there, and it was too much to think that someone could get a bomb on the plane just when there was the bad thunderstorm. Known for, you know, flying in any kind of weather. And when Torrijos died, there became a power struggle. And the person who was the ablest, the most ruthless, was the one who won. And one of the reasons why he won was because the U.S. wanted him to win. The United States had then taken a fellow who started working for us when he was 15 or 16. Noriega had been an asset of one intelligence agency and then the CIA, and got him to be the dictator of Panama.
By then, Ronald Reagan was in the White House, where his administration began funding right-wing military and paramilitary groups in Central America.
Reagan turned his attention to Central America in a way that no other president had done in recent decades. This was the era of freedom fighters, support for the Nicaraguan insurgency against the Sandinistas, and again, Noriega was able to play this kind of double game. On the one hand, he had continued the reputation of being a kind of progressive, left-leaning military regime, but at the same time, he was collaborating with the CIA in really has to be described with what it was. It was terrorist activities, sabotage against the Nicaraguans.
One of the things he did to the U.S. was to help the clandestine airlift of weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua, and this was against a law the United States Congress had passed, a series of amendments forbidding that stuff. So he was making sure that the United States could get guns shipped down from Beaumont, Texas, to clandestine airstrips in Central America that Noriega had set up for his own smuggling operations. But then when the planes went back to the States, they were empty. So what did he do? He put drugs on them. And that was the kind of thing that Noriega couldn't stop doing. He couldn't stop working one side and working the other side at the same time. He couldn't be straight. He couldn't do things without messing up, because as he got higher and higher, the different roles he was playing were conflicting. And you can very well imagine how annoyed people got in Washington over this. The main problem, though, wasn't Noriega. The problem was that we had a visible government run by Ronald Reagan and an invisible government, which Ollie North took the blame for running, but which I think was run by George Herbert Walker Bush.
You're listening to Rear Vision on Radio National Summer. I'm Keri Phillips, and today, as former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega serves another jail sentence, this time in France, we're tracking his passage from valued CIA asset to drug smuggling pariah. By 1983, Noriega was the de facto leader of Panama. He was the head of intelligence, head of the armed forces, and controlled the president, who was a civilian but really a creature of the military. But the U.S. administration was beginning to communicate its displeasure at his drug-related activities. Noriega made what would prove to be several costly mistakes. In October 1984, he allowed the first presidential elections in 16 years.
This was an election engineered by the military, supposedly to return the country to civilian rule. However, the United States was able to document that it was a crooked election, that the election had been fixed. I was able to then get a hold of the documents by the U.S. government proving that this was a fixed election. I used those documents to then interview several Panamanians who admitted to me that they had participated in the fixing of that election. So the tensions around this fixed election, the disagreements over drug trafficking, and Noriega's, I think, his own arrogance became a mounting problem for the United States. Human rights violations were increasing. There was a famous case of one of the principal and most famous opposition figures, a man named Hugo Spadafora, who was kind of the moral leader of the opposition to Noriega. He had been very close to the military. He turned against Noriega and began speaking very openly about Noriega's corruption and particularly about the drug trafficking, and was supposedly keeping records of this and ready to denounce this internationally. His headless body was discovered in 1985. This happened to be at a time when I was visiting Panama, and it's how I got interested in the story. His head actually has never been found. And this case became so egregious that it became a kind of cause celebre, even with the United States.
Panama's President Barletta was visiting New York City at the time. A reporter asked him about the Spadafora murder, and he promised an investigation. When he went back to Panama, though, he was forced to resign by Noriega.
Now Noriega, well, he'd fixed an election, he'd stopped the investigation of a ghastly, macabre, torture, decapitation, murder of a very popular political leader. He's intimidating the press. This might get him in trouble. He worried, but as it turned out, and I know he was worried because I talked to his people who were around him at the time, it was as if none of these things had happened. His relationship with William Casey, the head of the CIA, prospered. He visited Washington, was always welcome in Casey's office. Also, Colonel Oliver North, the White House figure who was involved in the Iran-Contra fiascos, began to visit. One of the people who sat in on the meetings told me that to North, Noriega was like Brando, Up the River in Apocalypse Now, No Rules. And they met several times over the years. Last time, I think, was September of 1986, just before the Iran-Contra scandal broke in the papers and things were beginning to change.
The most significant of these for Noriega would be the election of Reagan's deputy, George H.W. Bush, as president in 1988. The Cold War was coming to an end, and the war against communism was about to be replaced by the war on drugs. Despite Noriega's former connections with Bush, the U.S. Justice Department had been building a case against him and indicted him on drug trafficking charges in 1988.
When George H.W. Bush ran for president in 1988, the path to the invasion really began there. Ronald Reagan had said he'd be willing to drop the indictments if Noriega left Panama, stepped down. Huge political uproar. For the first time, people saying you can't let a drug dealer go. Vice President Bush broke with Reagan for the first time and became president, inaugurated in 1989, with essentially very little wiggle room. He had abandoned the idea of negotiating with Noriega, and he began talking, as the year went on, to really accelerate the story. The Panamanians have to do it themselves. And are you suggesting they have a coup? I'm saying what I'm saying. And he essentially encouraged, in public appearances and everything, a coup. He got it in early October 1989. Panamanians, listening to what he had said, they had a coup, bungled the whole affair. And Noriega was back in power again, the coup makers whom the U.S. had encouraged, dead and mocked by U.S. politicians for their ineptitude. And now the game was, there had to be an invasion, because he was becoming a truly serious political embarrassment to Bush, and not really concealing it. He would tell reporters and other people, I have Bush by the balls.
The United States invasion of Panama, codenamed Operation Just Cause, happened in December 1989. John Weeks is Professor Emeritus at the University of London and the author, with Phil Gunson, of Panama, Made in the USA.
It's frequently referred to as the invasion of Panama. Strictly speaking, it wasn't an invasion because all the troops that were used were actually already in Panama. They were in the canal zone where the United States had the right to maintain troops to protect the canal. And there were almost 28,000 U.S. troops there, and there were airplanes and the whole array of tanks, everything you needed for a military operation. By the way, at that time, the Panamanian military was about 16,000. And when they got additional support from the United States, particularly in the form of airplanes, there was no question about who was going to win the battle.
I think the embarrassment factor, together with the fact that he consciously and publicly tweaked the United States, challenged the United States, refused to kind of be a quiet dictator in Central America, of which Central America is famous, instead made himself an issue. And this is the country that, of course, has the Panama Canal and the Panama Canal Zone and an enormous array of military bases. I'm not justifying this, but I think that the United States government during the Bush administration concluded that they could not have somebody that out of control in a country like Panama, which essentially is a kind of a quasi-colony of the United States.
The U.S. government has offered $1 million reward for the capture of Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega. The Pentagon says 15 U.S. soldiers have been killed since 20,000 troops invaded Panama to bring Noriega to trial in the United States, where he's wanted on drug trafficking charges.
Manuel Noriega, who was yesterday's maximum leader, is today's hunted fugitive.
He's a crafty devil, as you know. He allegedly changes his place of residence about four times a night. We thought we had a pretty good idea of where he was last night there, and he wasn't there.
Well, he had taken refuge in the embassy of the Vatican, and then there's a certain degree of farce. The U.S. surrounded the embassy and blared out deafening rock music to try to, I guess, encourage him to surrender. And eventually he did surrender. I think the Vatican took the position that they did not want the bad publicity of keeping him forever, which in effect they would have had to do.
When Noriega surrendered to the U.S. military on January the 3rd, 1990, he was immediately put on a plane and flown to Miami. In April 1992, he went on trial, charged with drug trafficking, racketeering and money laundering. John Dingers.
The way the trial was initially promoted by Noriega's lawyers was that this is going to be a trial of this CIA collaborator, Manuel Noriega, who has been turned on by his former bosses in the CIA and the U.S. government, and that his defense was going to be that he had been working for the CIA so closely that anything that he was accused of doing must have also involved the CIA. And so we were told, and I was, of course, very interested in this because I was convinced that Noriega knew an enormous amount of what the CIA was doing in Central America at that time, not only in Panama, of course, but in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, all of these hotspots, the CIA was very active. And in fact, in the early submissions, written submissions for the trial, here's what I'm going to show in the trial, in which he talked about the CIA activity. But I started to get suspicious that this might not be everything it was put up to be, because I noticed that in these written documents, there were long sections that had been taken verbatim from my own book, in which I was talking about Noriega's relationship with the CIA. They had just taken that and made it part of their legal papers. And I thought, wait a minute, if they're using my book to substantiate his relationship with the CIA, that must mean that Noriega himself is not telling his lawyers any new information.
He was put on trial, and I want the people in Australia to know I'm a patriotic American, but that trial was one of the worst things that ever happened in our country. It was fixed from the very beginning, and every witness was bribed, not with money, but they were all criminals, and they were giving these witnesses so much for flipping on Noriega that from time to time I wished I'd been indicted myself. Noriega was guilty of so many crimes. Noriega wasn't innocent of anything. But it was a perversion of the American justice system.
Did he give evidence, Noriega?
Noriega never said a peep about anything. And I understand that, too, because if I had been there when they were putting him away, I would have said something like this, and I believe that people said something like this, that you're going to have a very comfortable confinement. But if you feel like shooting your mouth off, it would be wise not to eat the food or drink the water. He dealt in and with people. He dealt in business where killing people was nothing, and he dealt with people for whom killing people was nothing. And all his life, he lived in that kind of world. He was part of that world.
Now let's go to Miami, Florida, where a jury has convicted Panama's former dictator, Manuel Noriega, on 8 charges of drug trafficking, conspiracy, and racketeering. Noriega now faces life in jail.
Just minutes after the verdict was announced in Miami, President Bush spoke to reporters at the White House.
Well, I think it's a major victory against the drug lords. We're going to continue the fight against drugs in every way possible. But I think it's significant that he was accorded a free and fair trial, and he was found guilty. And I hope it sends a lesson to drug lords here and around the world that they'll pay a price if they continue to poison the lives of our kids in this country or anywhere else.
Among the witnesses were 20 convicted drug dealers who had reached plea agreements with the government in the hope of receiving reduced sentences. General Manuel Antonio Noriega, the former leader of Panama, was found guilty of 8 counts of cocaine trafficking, racketeering and money laundering, marking the first time in American history convicted a foreign head of state of criminal charges. Not everyone was equally happy with the verdict. Noriega's lawyer, Frank Rubino.
Today the people of the United States, via this jury, have sent a message to the rest of the world leaders that you too may someday be in our courthouse for alleged crimes you committed in your own countries. that the United States will now trample across the entire world, imposing its will upon so-called independent sovereign nations.
I think there's no doubt that the United States acted illegally in the way that they tried him, the U.S. government did. He was the head of state. He was also captured in a military operation, which made him a prisoner of war. The question of whether he had carried out civil crimes then becomes an extremely complex one under the law. As you recall, much more recently, when Pinochet was arrested in Britain and threatened with trial in Spain, very complicated legal issues came up as to whether or not the crimes that he was alleged to have carried out, Pinochet was alleged to have carried out while he was president, whether he could be tried for them in another country. I would say the same issue arises with Noriega. In fact, once he was convicted in a normal civil criminal court in Florida and sentenced to life imprisonment, subsequently a federal judge held that legally he was a prisoner of war.
He therefore had the facilities in the jail in Miami that were what an American general would have. According to the Geneva Conventions, if he was a POW, he was not with the general population, wasn't in a cell, lived in a small house with a living room, bedroom, private toilet, shower facilities, a microwave, a television, and a telephone. And I talked to lawyers and people close to him. Family visited regularly. He has six grandchildren now in Miami and Panama. Read political books, newspapers. Also mathematics books, books of math problems to keep his mind nimble. And about 6 weeks before his expected release, he completed his term, as I say, on one day in August of 07. Suddenly the French asked for his extradition.
Manuel Noriega was held as he fought extradition to France, unsuccessfully as it turned out. Late last month, he was flown to Paris, where he waits in jail for a new trial on the old charges of laundering $3 million in drug money. If convicted again, he could face a further 10 years in prison there. Looking back on the Noriega story, John Weeks sees the invasion of Panama and the arrest and trial of its military dictator as a turning point in the expression of U.S. power in Latin America.
Because not only was Noriega overthrown, but the new president, the person who replaced him, Guillermo Indara, was sworn in as president of Panama on a U.S. military base. I mean, this really is a throwback to the 19th century. So I think that the assertion of U.S. hegemony through that invasion was something so flagrant that it outrage the government of America, and I think eventually has led to a political culture that the U.S. should not be allowed to do such things in the future. The invasion of Panama by the first Bush administration was, I would say, the last gasp of U.S. overt imperialism in Latin America, and that is something that marked the end of an era.
On Rear Vision today, we heard R.M. Costa, John Dingers, John Weeks, and Kevin Buckley, and you'll find the details of all their books on the Rear Vision website. Over the summer, if you'd like to catch up on programs you've missed or even delve into the Rear Vision archives, you'll find audio and transcripts going back almost 5 years on our website, abc.net.au/rn/rearvision, or just Google Rear Vision and then click on past programs. Phil McKellar is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips.
With ABC Radio National, you can change the way you listen. By using audio on demand or subscribing to a free podcast, you can choose when and how you hear our programs. Most of our content is available online, and millions of downloads are being enjoyed each month. There's also an extensive back catalogue of programs and features, providing an invaluable free resource. Time shift your listening at abc.net.au/rn.